The Man in the Brown Suit, Agatha Christie, Chapter 4. Nobody came forward to identify the dead woman. The inquest elicited the following facts. Shortly after 1 o'clock on January 8th, a well-dressed woman with a slight foreign accent had entered the offices of Messrs. Butler and Park, house agents in Knightsbridge. She explained that she wanted to rent or purchase a house on the Thames, within easy reach of London. The particulars of several were given to her, including those of the Mill House. She gave the name of Mrs. de Castina and her address as the Ritz, but there proved to be no one of that name staying there, and the hotel people failed to identify the body. Mrs. James, the wife of Sir Eustace Pedler's gardener, who acted as caretaker to the Mill House and inhabited the small lodge opening on the main road, gave evidence. About 3 o'clock that afternoon, a lady came to see over the house. She produced an order from the house agents, and, as was the usual custom, Mrs. James gave her the keys of the house. It was situated at some distance from the lodge, and she was not in the habit of accompanying prospective tenants. A few minutes later, a young man arrived. Mrs. James described him as tall and broad-shouldered, with a bronzed face and light gray eyes. He was clean-shaven and was wearing a brown suit. He explained to Mrs. James that he was a friend of the lady who had come to look over the house, but had stopped at the post office to send a telegram. She directed him to the house and thought no more about the matter. 5 minutes later, he reappeared, handed her back the keys, and explained that he feared the house would not suit them. Mrs. James did not see the lady, but thought that she'd gone on ahead. What she did notice was that the young man seemed very much upset about something. "He looked like a man who'd seen a ghost. I thought he was taken ill." On the following day, another lady and gentleman came to see the property and discovered the body lying on the floor in one of the upstairs rooms. Mrs. James identified it as that of the lady who'd come the day before. The house agents also recognized it as that of Mrs. de Castina. The police surgeon gave it as his opinion that the woman had been dead about 24 hours. The Daily Budget had jumped to the conclusion that the man in the tube had murdered the woman and afterwards committed suicide. However, as the tube victim was dead at 2 o'clock, and the woman was alive and well at 3 o'clock, the only logical conclusion to come to was that the two occurrences had nothing to do with each other, and that the order to view the house at Marlow, found in the dead man's pocket, was merely one of those coincidences which so often occur in life. A verdict of willful murder against some person or persons unknown was returned, and the police and the Daily Budget were left to look for the man in the brown suit. Since Mrs. James was positive that there was no one in the house when the lady entered it, and that nobody except the young man in question entered it until the following afternoon, it seemed only logical to conclude that he was the murderer of the unfortunate Mrs. de Castina. She had been strangled with a piece of stout black cord, and had evidently been caught unawares with no time to cry out. The black silk handbag which she carried contained a well-filled note-case and some loose change, a fine lace handkerchief, unmarked, and the return half of a first-class ticket to London. Nothing much there to go upon. Such were the details, published, broadcast, by the Daily Budget, and "Find the man in the brown suit" was their daily war cry. On an average, about 500 people wrote daily to announce their success in the quest, and tall young men with well-tanned faces cursed the day when their tailors had persuaded them to a brown suit. The accident in the tube, dismissed as a coincidence, faded out of the public mind. Was it a coincidence? I was not so sure. No doubt I was prejudiced. The tube incident was my own pet mystery. But there certainly seemed to me to be a connection of some kind between the two fatalities. In each there was a man with a tanned face, evidently an Englishman living abroad, and there were other things. It was the consideration of these other things that finally impelled me to what I considered a dashing step. I presented myself at Scotland Yard and demanded to see whoever was in charge of the Millhouse case. My request took some time to understand, as I had inadvertently selected the department for lost umbrellas, but eventually I was ushered into a small room and presented to Detective Inspector Meadows. Inspector Meadows was a small man with a ginger head and what I considered a peculiarly irritating manner. A satellite, also in plain clothes, sat unobtrusively in a corner. "Good morning," I said nervously. "Good morning. Will you take a seat? I understand you've got something to tell me you think may be of use to us." His tone seemed to indicate that such a thing was unlikely in the extreme. I felt my temper stirred. "Of course you know about the man who was killed in the tube. The man who had an order to view this same house at Marlowe in his pocket." "Ah," said the inspector, "you are the Miss Bedingfeld who gave evidence at the inquest. Certainly the man had an order in his pocket. A lot of other people may have had too, only they didn't happen to be killed." I rallied my forces. "You don't think it odd that this man had no ticket in his pocket?" "Easiest thing in the world to drop your ticket. Done it myself." "And no money?" "He had some loose change in his trouser pockets." "But no note case?" "Some men don't carry a pocketbook or note case of any kind." I tried another tack. "You don't think it's odd that the doctor never came forward afterwards?" "A busy medical man very often doesn't read the papers. He probably forgot all about the accident." "In fact, Inspector, you're determined to find nothing odd," I said sweetly. "Well, I'm inclined to think you're a little too fond of the word, Miss Bedingfeld. Young ladies are romantic, I know, fond of mysteries and such like. But as I'm a busy man," I took the hint and rose. The man in the corner raised a meek voice. "Perhaps the young lady would tell us briefly what her ideas really are on the subject, Inspector." The inspector fell in with the suggestion readily enough. "Yes, come now, Miss Bedingfeld, don't be offended. You've asked questions and hinted things. Just say straight out what it is you've got in your head." I wavered between injured dignity and the overwhelming desire to express my theories. Injured dignity went to the wall. "You said at the inquest you were positive it wasn't suicide."
"Yes, I'm quite certain of that. The man was frightened." "What frightened him? It wasn't me. But someone might have been walking up the platform towards us. Someone he recognized."
"You didn't see anyone?"
"No," I admitted. "I didn't turn my head. Then, as soon as the body was recovered from the line, a man pushed forward to examine it, saying he was a doctor."
"Nothing unusual in that," said the inspector dryly.
"But he wasn't a doctor."
"What?"
"He wasn't a doctor," I repeated.
"How do you know that, Miss Bedingfeld?"
"It's difficult to say exactly. I've worked in hospital during the war, and I've seen doctors handle bodies. There's a sort of deft professional callousness that this man hadn't got. Besides, a doctor doesn't usually feel for the heart on the right side of the body."
"He did that?"
"Yes. I didn't notice it specially at the time, except that I felt there was something wrong. But I worked it out when I got home, and then I saw why the whole thing had looked so unhandy to me at the time."
"Hmm," said the inspector. He was reaching slowly for pen and paper.
"In running his hands over the upper part of the man's body, he would have ample opportunity to take anything he wanted from the pockets."
"Doesn't sound likely to me," said the inspector. "But, well, can you describe him at all?"
"He was tall and broad-shouldered, wore a dark overcoat and black boots, a bowler hat. He had a dark pointed beard and gold-rimmed glasses."
"Take away the overcoat, the beard, and the eyeglasses, and there wouldn't be much to know him by," grumbled the inspector.
He could alter his appearance easy enough in 5 minutes if he wanted to, which he would do if he's the swell pickpocket you suggest. I had not intended to suggest anything of the kind, but from this moment I gave the inspector up as hopeless. "Nothing more you can tell us about him?" he demanded as I rose to depart. "Yes," I said. I seized my opportunity to fire a parting shot. "His head was markedly brachycephalic. He will not find it so easy to alter that." I observed with pleasure that Inspector Meadows' pen wavered. It was clear that he didn't know how to spell brachycephalic. Chapter 5. In the first heat of indignation, I found my next step unexpectedly easy to tackle. I had had a half-formed plan in my head when I went into Scotland Yard, one to be carried out if my interview there was unsatisfactory. It had been profoundly unsatisfactory. That is, if I had the nerve to go through with it. Things that one would shrink from attempting normally are easily tackled in a flush of anger. Without giving myself time to reflect, I walked straight to the house of Lord Nasby. Lord Nasby was the millionaire owner of the Daily Budget. He owned other papers, several of them, but the Daily Budget was his special child. It was as the owner of the Daily Budget that he was known to every householder in the United Kingdom, owing to the fact that an itinerary of the great man's daily proceedings had just been published. I knew exactly where to find him at this moment. It was his hour for dictating to his secretary in his own house. I didn't, of course, suppose that any young woman who chose to come and ask for him would be at once admitted to the august presence, but I had attended to that side of the matter. In the card tray in the hall of the Fleming's house, I had observed the card of the Marquis de Lomsley, England's most famous sporting peer. I had removed the card, cleaned it carefully with breadcrumbs, and penciled upon it the words, "Please give Miss Bedingfield a few moments of your time." Adventuresses must not be too scrupulous in their methods. The thing worked. A powdered footman received the card and bore it away. Presently, a pale secretary appeared. I fenced with him successfully. He retired defeated. He again reappeared and begged me to follow him. I did so. I entered a large room. A frightened-looking, shorthand typist fled past me like a visitant from the spirit world. Then the door shut, and I was face to face with Lord Nasby. A big man, big head, big face, big mustache, big stomach. I pulled myself together. I had not come here to comment on Lord Nasby's stomach. He was already roaring at me. "Well, what is it? What does Lomsley want? You his secretary? What's it all about?" "To begin with," I said with as great an appearance of coolness as I could manage, "I don't know Lord Lomsley, and he certainly knows nothing about me. I took his card from the tray in the house of the people I'm staying with, and I wrote those words on it myself. It was important that I should see you." For a moment, it appeared to be a toss-up as to whether Lord Nasby had apoplexy or not. In the end, he swallowed twice and got over it. "I admire your coolness, young woman." "Well, you see me. If you interest me, you will continue to see me for exactly 2 minutes longer." "That will be ample," I replied, "and I shall interest you. It's the Millhouse mystery."
"If you found the man in the brown suit, write to the editor," he interrupted hastily.
"If you will interrupt, I shall be more than 2 minutes," I said sternly. "I haven't found the man in the brown suit, but I'm quite likely to do so." In as few words as possible, I put the facts of the tube accident and the conclusions I had drawn from them before him. When I had finished, he said unexpectedly,
"What do you know of brachycephalic heads?"
I mentioned Papa.
"The monkey man, eh? Well, you seem to have a head of some kind upon your own shoulders, young woman. But it's all pretty thin, you know. Not much to go upon. And no use to us, as it stands."
"I'm perfectly aware of that."
"What do you want, then?"
"I want a job on your paper to investigate this matter.
Can't do that. We've got our own special man on it.
And I've got my own special knowledge.
What you've just told me, eh?
Oh, no, Lord Nasby. I've still got something up my sleeve.
Oh, you have you? You seem a bright sort of girl. Well, what is it?
When this so-called doctor got into the lift, he dropped a piece of paper. I picked it up. It smelt of mothballs. So did the dead man. The doctor didn't. So I saw at once that the doctor must have taken it off the body. It had two words written on it and some figures.
Let's see it. Lord Nasby stretched out a careless hand.
I think not, I said, smiling. It's my find, you see.
I'm right. You are a bright girl. Quite right to hang on to it. No scruples about not handing it over to the police?
I went there to do so this morning. They persisted in regarding the whole thing as having nothing to do with the Marlowe affair, so I thought that in the circumstances, I was justified in retaining the paper. Besides, the inspector put my back up.
Short-sighted man. Well, my dear girl, here's all I can do for you. Go on working on this line of yours. If you get anything that's publishable, send it along and you shall have your chance. There's always room for real talent on the Daily Budget. But you've got to make good first, see?
I thanked him and apologized for my methods.
Don't mention it. I rather like cheek from a pretty girl. By the way, you said 2 minutes and you've been three, allowing for interruptions. For a woman, that's quite remarkable. Must be your scientific training.
I was in the street again, breathing hard as though I'd been running. I found Lord Nasby rather wearing as a new acquaintance.